You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
Story 1, growing up in rural Virginia, I'd heard plenty of stories around campfires. The usual local legends and haunted houses that every small town has. But I was always the skeptic, rolling my eyes while my friends got spooked. That changed during my first year as a homeowner. My house wasn't anything special. A modest 1960s ranch-style place on the edge of town that needed work but fit my budget. The previous owners had been an elderly couple who'd lived there for decades before passing away within months of each other. Their children just wanted to sell quickly and move on. I'd been living there about 3 months when it happened. It was mid-October, unusually cold for that time of year. I remember because the heating system was struggling, making these weird clicking sounds as it cycled on and off throughout the night. That Wednesday, I got home from work around 6 p.m. I was exhausted from a long shift at the hospital where I worked as a lab tech. All I wanted was a hot shower and to collapse on the couch with takeout. I had just stepped out of the shower when I heard it, a sound like someone clearing their throat. I froze, towel in hand. "Hello," I called out, immediately feeling stupid. I lived alone, and I knew I'd locked the door. Nothing. Just the usual house creaks and the distant hum of my refrigerator. I brushed it off as house noises. Old homes make all kinds of sounds as they settle, right? I got dressed, ordered Chinese food, and tried to focus on the TV show I was half watching. That's when I heard it again. A man's voice, soft but clear, saying what sounded like, "Cold tonight." I shot up from the couch, heart pounding. "Who's there?" I shouted, grabbing my phone, ready to call 911. My house wasn't big, just two bedrooms, a bathroom, kitchen, and living room. There weren't many places someone could hide. I did a quick search of every room, even checking closets and under the beds like a kid afraid of monsters. Nothing. No signs of a break-in. All windows locked, back doors still bolted from the inside. I told myself it must have been the TV, though I knew it wasn't. I turned up the volume, trying to drown out my unease, when the doorbell rang, just my delivery driver with the food. After eating, I felt more rational. Houses make noise. Maybe it was the pipes or the heating system. I decided to go to bed early and forget about it. Around 3 a.m., I woke up suddenly. The house was silent except for the faint ticking of my bedside clock. Then I heard it distinctly, a man's voice right below me saying, "Can you hear me up there?" My blood turned to ice. The voice was coming from beneath my bedroom floor. "I know you're awake," the voice continued. "I can hear you breathing." I lay perfectly still, too terrified to move. My bedroom was at the end of the hall, directly above the crawl space that ran under half the house, a crawl space I'd never bothered to inspect since moving in. "Don't be scared," the voice said, sounding closer now as if right under my bed. "I've been waiting for someone to talk to." I reached for my phone with a shaking hand. But what would I tell the police? That there was a voice coming from under my floorboards? They'd think I was crazy or drunk. "I'm going to count to three," the voice said. "Then I want you to answer me. One, two." I bolted from the bed and ran to the hallway, flipping on every light switch I passed. My mind was racing. If someone was under the house, they must be getting in somehow. Standing in my kitchen, I remembered the access hatch to the crawl space was outside, around the back of the house. It had a padlock on it. I'd seen it during the home inspection, but maybe it was broken. "Don't leave yet," the voice called from the direction of my bedroom. "I've been so lonely." That's when I heard a distinct scratching sound, like fingernails dragging slowly across the underside of my bedroom floor. I grabbed my car keys and ran out the front door in my pajamas, not even stopping to put on shoes. I drove straight to a 24-hour diner and sat there until sunrise, calling in sick to work. When I returned home with a police officer I'd convinced to check the property, we found the crawl space padlock intact and undisturbed. The officer shined his flashlight around inside but found nothing except dust, insulation, and some old pipes. "No signs anyone's been under here," he said, looking at me like I was wasting his time. "No footprints in the dirt. No disturbances at all." I couldn't explain it, and I was starting to doubt myself. Maybe it had been a vivid nightmare. That evening, I called a locksmith to replace the padlock anyway, just to be sure. While he was working, he mentioned something that made my skin crawl. "You know, the last owners installed this heavy-duty lock after they found a homeless guy living under here. This was years ago, though. Guy apparently had been there for months before they discovered him. Tragic case. They found him dead under the main bedroom. Hypothermia during a cold snap." I never heard the voice again after that day. Story 2. I'm Jake, born and raised in Fairfax County, Virginia, a place swimming in Civil War history. Growing up surrounded by all these historic sites, you get used to field trips to old battlefields and plantations. Most were boring as hell, but this one was different. It was October 2014, I was in fifth grade, and our class took a trip to Belgrove Plantation near the Cedar Creek battlefield. The place was impressive, big white columns out front with visible damage from Civil War bullets. But whatever, I was 10 and mostly concerned with sitting next to my friends on the bus. The tour guide, this older lady with a thick Southern accent, was leading us through the mansion. We ended up in this big kitchen with massive double doors on either side, both standing open to let in the autumn breeze. The room still had the original brick oven and these creepy old utensils hanging on the walls. "Now, children, this kitchen would have been bustling with activity," the guide was saying, "with enslaved people preparing meals for the plantation owners," and that's when I heard it. A woman humming. It was faint but clear, coming from outside one of the doorways that led to the garden. The melody was strange, not like anything I recognized. Old sounding. Mrs. Peterson, our teacher's aide, who we all called Bulldog, behind her back, she had this underbite and was always snarling at us, suddenly cut off the tour guide. "Which one of you is humming?" she snapped. "Stop it right now." We all looked at each other, confused. Nobody was making any noise. "I said cut it out," she repeated, glaring at us. "It's coming from outside," I said, pointing to the garden doorway. Bulldog rolled her eyes but walked over to the doorway and peered out. She frowned, then actually stepped outside. We watched through the doorway as she looked around the garden, turning in a complete circle. When she came back in, her face had changed. "There's nobody out there," she said quietly to the tour guide. The tour guide got this weird look on her face. "Let me check the other side," she said, heading toward the opposite doorway. The humming grew louder while she was gone. It was a woman's voice, soft but clear, like she was right outside the door. The melody was repetitive, almost like a lullaby, but with something off about it. The tour guide returned, her face pale. "There's no one outside," she said. "Let's move on to the dining room, shall we?" She hurried us out of the kitchen, practically shoving kids through the doorway. As I left, I glanced back. Through the garden doorway, I swear I saw movement. Just a flash of gray, like the hem of a dress disappearing around a corner. The rest of the tour was rushed. The guide kept looking over her shoulder, and Bulldog stayed close to our group instead of bringing up the rear like usual. Something had spooked them both. On the bus ride home, I overheard Bulldog talking to our teacher. "I heard it clear as day," she whispered, "standing right in that garden, humming, but there was no one there. Nothing." 3 years later, I was at the county library working on a history project when I came across a book called Haunted Virginia. I flipped through it out of curiosity and froze when I saw a chapter on Belgrove Plantation. According to the book, in 1864, the lady of the house, Elizabeth Hite, was found badly beaten in the smokehouse. She had distinct bruises shaped like handprints on her face and neck. She died 3 days later, never regaining consciousness. A young enslaved girl was accused of the murder. Despite her protestations of innocence, she was hanged within a week. The book claimed that Elizabeth had been known for her habit of walking in the garden every afternoon, humming the same melody as she tended to her flowers. And since her death, visitors and staff at Belgrove have reported hearing a woman humming in the garden. Always the same strange tune, always when no one is there. I never told anyone about finding that book. Story 3, I never believed in ghosts, not until last winter. I'm Lucas, 32, living in a small two-bedroom house in rural Maine that I inherited from my grandparents. The nearest neighbor is about half a mile away, and the dense pine forest surrounding my property makes it feel even more isolated. I've always been fine with that. I work remotely as a software developer, and the quiet helps me focus. The night it happened, we'd had a massive snowstorm. Power was flickering all evening, and I'd already set up candles and a flashlight by my bed just in case. Around midnight, I finally fell asleep to the sound.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Sound of wind howling through the trees. I woke up suddenly at 3:17 a.m. I remember the time because I immediately checked my phone when I heard the noise. A distinct tapping sound was coming from my living room window. Three quick taps, pause, three more taps. At first, I thought it was just ice or a tree branch, but it was too rhythmic, too deliberate. I lay there frozen under my covers, listening as the tapping continued. Tap, tap, tap. Pause, tap, tap, tap. "It's nothing," I whispered to myself, trying to calm down. "Probably just the wind." But then I heard something worse, the sound of my front door squeaking open, followed by footsteps in the entryway. My heart nearly burst out of my chest. I live alone. Nobody else has keys. The door had definitely been locked. I always double-check before bed. The footsteps were slow, dragging almost. They moved from the entryway into the living room, then stopped. I couldn't breathe. I reached for my phone to call 911, but my hands were shaking so badly I could barely hold it. Then the temperature in my bedroom plummeted. I could see my breath forming clouds in the air. The footsteps started again, heading down the hallway toward my room. Thump, drag, thump, drag. I sat up, clutching my blanket, eyes fixed on my bedroom door, which I'd left slightly ajar. The footsteps got closer, louder, and then they stopped, right outside my room. The door slowly pushed open wider. Nothing was there. Nothing I could see, anyway. But the space in my doorway wasn't empty. I could feel a presence, something watching me. "Who's there?" I managed to croak out. My voice sounded like it belonged to someone else. No response, just the sound of breathing, raspy, wet breathing, coming from the empty doorway. Then my bedside lamp turned on by itself, and that's when I saw it, not directly, but in the mirror on my closet door. A figure stood in my doorway. It was tall, impossibly thin, with skin that looked gray and waterlogged. Its face was mostly obscured by long, stringy black hair, but I could see its mouth, stretched into a grin that was far too wide for any human face. I couldn't move, couldn't scream, could barely breathe. It took one step into my room. In the mirror, I watched it raise one long-fingered hand and point directly at me. "Remember me?" it whispered. The voice was distorted, like someone speaking underwater, but somehow familiar. That's when recognition hit me like a truck. 2 years ago, a kayaker had gone missing on the lake behind my property. They found his body 3 weeks later, tangled in weeds at the bottom of the lake. I'd been the last person to see him alive, waving to him from my back deck as he paddled out into the fog. "You saw me," the thing rasped. "You could have warned me about the storm." I couldn't respond. Terror had completely paralyzed me. The figure moved to the foot of my bed, still only visible to me through the mirror. Water began dripping from it, pooling on my hardwood floor. "I just wanted someone to know what happened," it said. "Someone needs to know." Suddenly, it was right next to me, its face inches from mine. I could smell lake water and decay. "I got caught in weeds," it whispered directly into my ear. Panicked, tipped over. My leg was tangled. I tried to get free for hours. Nobody heard me screaming. I felt cold, wet fingers touch my arm, and I finally found my voice and screamed. The lamp exploded with a loud pop, plunging the room back into darkness. When I managed to turn on my phone's flashlight with trembling hands, the figure was gone. The only evidence it had been there was a puddle of water on my floor and lakeweeds scattered across my bed. I spent the rest of the night sitting in my car with the engine running and lights on. When morning came, I drove straight to the police station to tell them what happened. They thought I was crazy or on drugs, but when they reluctantly checked it out, they found something that made their faces go pale. The kayaker's water-damaged phone sitting on my kitchen counter. It hadn't been recovered with his body. On it was a video, his final moments, fighting to free himself from the weeds as water slowly filled his kayak. I put my house up for sale the next day. Story 4. I never believed in ghosts, not until last winter when I moved into that old farmhouse outside of Millfield, Minnesota. I'm Sarah, 34, elementary school teacher by day, and apparently ghost magnet by night. The house was a steal. That should have been my first warning. But when you're a single mom with mounting debt and a 7-year-old who needs stability, you take what you can get. "Mom, this place smells funny," Lily said when we first walked through the creaking front door. "It's just old house smell, sweetie. Nothing some air fresheners can't fix," I assured her, though I'd noticed it too. A strange metallic smell that lingered in certain areas of the house. The first month was uneventful. We settled in, unpacked our boxes, and tried to make this drafty old farmhouse feel like home. I chalked up the occasional odd sound to the house settling or the wind whistling through the poorly sealed windows. That was until the night of January 17th. I woke up around 3 a.m. to what sounded like scratching inside the walls of my bedroom. Not the gentle scrape of a tree branch or the scurrying of a mouse. This was deliberate, slow, like fingernails dragging across the inside of the plaster. Scratch, scratch, pause, scratch. I froze, holding my breath, straining to hear in the darkness. "Hello?" I called out stupidly, as if whatever was making that sound would politely respond. The scratching stopped immediately. The silence that followed was somehow worse. I convinced myself it was just the old pipes, or maybe some animal that had found its way into the walls. I even got up, turned on all the lights, and checked on Lily, who was sleeping peacefully in her room across the hall. After finding nothing, I eventually went back to bed, though sleep didn't come easily. The next night, nothing happened, or the night after that. I started to think maybe I'd imagined it or dreamed it. Then came Friday night. Lily was at a sleepover at her friend's house, so I was alone. I'd fallen asleep on the couch watching Netflix when something woke me up. That same scratching sound, but this time it wasn't coming from my bedroom wall. It was coming from directly behind the couch. Scratch, scratch, pause, scratch. My blood ran cold. I sat perfectly still, afraid to even breathe. Then the scratching changed. It became more purposeful, more rhythmic. It took me a moment to realize it was forming a pattern. Three short scratches, three long scratches, three short scratches. Over and over, SOS. That's when the whispering started. At first I thought it was just the wind, but then I could make out words, faint, barely audible, but unmistakably there. "Help us, please, help us." It was a child's voice. I scrambled off the couch so fast I knocked over my half-empty wine glass. The whispering stopped abruptly, but the scratching continued. "Who's there?" I demanded, my voice shaking. "This isn't funny." Silence fell over the house, complete suffocating silence. I turned on every light in the house and called my sister, who lived about an hour away. "There's someone in the wall," I told her, knowing how insane I sounded. "Sarah, old houses make weird noises," she said, trying to sound reasonable despite the obvious concern in her voice. "Remember when we were kids and we thought the attic was haunted? It was just raccoons." "This isn't raccoons, Jen. I heard voices. A child's voice asking for help." There was a long pause on the other end. "Have you been taking your anxiety medication?" I hung up on her. I knew what I'd heard. I spent the rest of the night sitting in my car in the driveway, too terrified to go back inside. When dawn broke, I felt ridiculous. In the harsh light of day, my fears seemed overblown. I went back inside to shower and change before picking up Lily. The house was quiet and normal. I even knocked on the wall where I'd heard the scratching half expecting it to be hollow or different somehow. It wasn't. That afternoon, I took Lily to the local library, more to distract myself than anything else. While she browsed the kids' section, I found myself looking up the history of my house. What I found made my stomach drop. In 1952, a family of four had lived in my house, the Millers. According to old newspaper articles, the parents were arrested for child abuse. The two children, aged 6 and 8, were found locked inside a hidden room in the walls of the farmhouse. They'd been kept there for months, scratching messages to each other through the walls. Both children died shortly after being rescued, severely malnourished and ill. The article included a grainy black and white photo of the farmhouse, my farmhouse. I felt sick. Could it be possible? Were those children still somehow there? That night, I tucked Lily into bed and sat on the edge of her mattress longer than usual, watching her chest rise and fall with each breath. "Mom, why do you look scared?" she asked, her little face serious in the glow of her nightlight. "Just tired, sweetie," I lied. "Sleep tight." I went to my room but didn't even try to sleep. Instead, I sat on my bed, back against the headboard, waiting. For what, I wasn't sure. Around 2:30 a.m., it started again. Scratch, scratch, pause, scratch. But this time, instead of freezing in fear, I took a deep breath and spoke to the darkness. "I know what happened to you," I said, my voice barely above a whisper. "I'm so sorry." The scratching stopped. For several long moments, there was nothing. Then, so faint I almost missed it. "Help us." I felt tears running down my cheeks. "How?" I whispered back. The temperature in the room plummeted. I could see my breath clouding in front of me. That's when I noticed something on the wall, marks appearing as if invisible fingers were dragging across the paint. FINDUS. I got up slowly, approached the wall, and placed my hand flat against it. The cold was intense, like placing my palm on a block of ice. "Where are you?" I asked. More scratching, more desperate now. Then the whispering intensified, becoming a chorus of children's voices, not just two, many, many more. "Find us, find us, find us, find us." The voices grew louder until they were shouting, screaming, the walls themselves seeming to vibrate with their desperation. I staggered backward, tripping over my own feet and falling hard onto the floor. The voices stopped abruptly. In the sudden silence, I heard the creak of my bedroom door opening. I looked up, expecting, hoping, to see Lily standing there. The doorway was empty. But then, in the hallway beyond, I saw them. The shadowy outlines of two small children, holding hands, staring at me with hollow dark eyes. One of them raised a finger to their lips. "Shh," they whispered in unison. "They'll hear you." Then they vanished, melting into the darkness of the hallway. I grabbed Lily from her bed and drove straight to my sister's house that night. We never went back. The farmhouse still stands empty. Sometimes I drive by it just to make sure it's still there, that it wasn't all some horrible dream. The for sale sign has been up for months. I've never told anyone the full story until now. I don't expect you to believe me. I wouldn't believe me either. But if you're ever driving through Millfield and see a charming old farmhouse with a suspiciously low asking price, keep driving, because some walls do more than just hold up the roof. Some walls hold secrets that should stay buried. Story 5. I've never told anyone this story because honestly, I don't think anyone would believe me. I still don't fully believe it myself, and I was there. I moved to Boston after college for work. Just a normal IT job, nothing special. The apartment I could afford was this old converted brownstone in Dorchester. Not the best area, but not the worst either. The building had that weird smell old buildings get, like decades of other people's lives soaked into the walls. It was January, so bitterly cold that the windows had frost on the inside. I remember because I'd been living there about 3 months when it happened, and I was still getting used to how drafty the place was. That night I was up late playing some game on my laptop. My roommate was out of town visiting family, so I had the place to myself. Around 3 a.m., I decided to finally call it quits and head to bed. I shut down my computer and went to brush my teeth. The bathroom was at the end of the hallway, and for some reason, I felt watched. You know that feeling when the hair on the back of your neck stands up? Like that, I flipped on the bathroom light, and as I was brushing, I swear to God I heard footsteps in the hallway. Not like someone sneaking around, but normal, casual footsteps. Like someone who lived there was just walking to their room. My first thought was that my roommate had come home early, so I called out, "Hey, Jake!" "That you?" "Nothing." I poked my head out of the bathroom, toothbrush still in my mouth, and looked down the empty hallway. No one there. "Whatever," I muttered, figuring it was just the old building settling. I finished brushing my teeth and headed back to my bedroom. As I was about to turn off the light, I heard three distinct knocks on my bedroom door. Knock, knock, knock. Slow, deliberate. My heart jumped into my throat. I stood there frozen, staring at the door, thinking maybe I'd imagined it. Then it happened again. Knock, knock, knock. "Jake," I called, my voice cracking. "This isn't funny, man." No answer. I don't know what possessed me, but I walked over to the door. My hand was shaking as I reached for the knob. I hesitated, took a deep breath, and yanked it open. The hallway was completely empty, but it was freezing cold. Like, unnaturally cold. I could see my breath in the air, which made no sense because the rest of the apartment was normal temperature. I quickly shut the door and locked it, telling myself I was being ridiculous. Old buildings make weird noises. That's all this was. I turned off the light and got into bed, pulling the covers up tight. I was just about to drift off when I heard it. "Let me in!" A voice right outside my door. Not shouting, not whispering, just a normal conversational tone. A woman's voice I didn't recognize. "Let me in. I'm cold." I sat bolt upright, heart hammering in my chest. "Who's there?" I demanded, trying to sound brave, but my voice betrayed me. "Let me in," she repeated. "I lived here before." I reached for my phone on the nightstand, ready to call 911, when my bedroom door started rattling. Not like someone was trying the knob, like someone was shaking the whole door in its frame. Bang, bang, bang. Not knocking anymore. Full on pounding. "Let me in!" The voice was angry now, desperate. I was paralyzed with fear, clutching my phone, unable to even dial. Then it stopped. Complete silence. I sat there for what felt like hours, afraid to move, afraid to breathe. Eventually, I managed to turn on my bedside lamp with trembling fingers. The silence stretched on, and I started to wonder if I'd dreamed the whole thing. Maybe I'd fallen asleep without realizing it. Slowly, I got out of bed and approached the door. I pressed my ear against it. Nothing. Gathering every ounce of courage I had, I unlocked the door and opened it just a crack. The hallway was empty and back to normal temperature. I was about to close the door when I noticed something on the floor just outside my room. Wet footprints. Small ones like a woman's bare feet. They led from the front door to my bedroom and then just stopped. I slammed the door shut and spent the rest of the night huddled in the corner of my room with all the lights on. The next day, I asked my landlord if anyone had ever died in the apartment. He looked uncomfortable and changed the subject. I moved out the following week. Never set foot in that building again. Story 6. 3 summers ago, I was 23 and had moved back in with my parents in Brookhaven after college. Money was tight, and their place near Wertheim Wildlife Refuge gave me somewhere to clear my head while job hunting. My dad mentioned that his buddy Mike, who worked at the refuge, had found something odd during a routine survey. What looked like an unmarked cemetery deep in the western section. Being a local history nerd, I decided to check it out. It was mid-July, hot as hell. I'd been hiking through Wertheim dozens of times, but always stuck to the marked trails. This time I had to use coordinates Mike had scribbled on a napkin, leading me way off the beaten path. After about an hour of pushing through thick underbrush, I came across a small clearing that just felt wrong. A rusted, partially collapsed iron fence surrounded what was unmistakably a cemetery, maybe 30 feet by 40 feet. Most of the headstones were tipped over or broken, but a few remained upright. "Hello?" I called out, feeling stupid immediately. Who was I expecting to answer? I stepped over the fallen fence and approached the nearest legible stone. The inscription read, "Martha Bartow, beloved wife and mother, 1798 to 1842. Several other stones bore the Bartow name. That's when I noticed how quiet it was. Living near Wertheim, you get used to constant noise. Birds singing, insects buzzing, leaves rustling. But in this cemetery, it was dead silent. No wind, no distant traffic, nothing. The silence felt physical, like pressure against my eardrums. "This is weird," I muttered, just to hear something. My voice sounded flat, like it couldn't travel more than a few feet. I walked further into the cemetery, taking photos with my phone. What struck me most was the ground itself. Nothing grew here. Outside the fence, the forest was lush and green, but inside was just bare dirt and dead leaves. I knelt down to examine one of the fallen headstones when a strange smell hit me, like wet soil and something metallic. Looking up, I noticed the trees surrounding the cemetery seemed wrong. Their branches curved away from the burial ground, as if trying to escape. The sunlight dimmed suddenly, though there wasn't a cloud in the sky. The temperature dropped at least 10 degrees in seconds. My breath fogged in front of my face. "What the hell?" I whispered. That's when I heard it, a soft scraping sound, like something being dragged across dirt. I turned slowly. About 20 feet away, near the back of the cemetery, the ground was moving, not shaking like an earthquake, actually bulging upward, as if something underneath was pushing against it. I couldn't move. My body felt frozen as the dirt mounted higher, maybe 8 or 10 inches above the surrounding ground. Then it stopped. The silence grew deeper. I could hear my heartbeat too fast and too loud. A single pale hand broke through the surface. It wasn't decomposed or skeletal. It looked like a normal human hand, fingers spread wide, reaching upward. The skin was alabaster white, with dirt caught under the fingernails. I stumbled backward, tripping over a headstone and falling hard. My phone flew from my hand. When I looked up again, the hand was gone. The mound of dirt had collapsed back into a flat surface, as if nothing had happened. I scrambled to my feet, grabbed my phone, and ran. I didn't stop until I reached the main trail, lungs burning and legs shaking. When I got home, I immediately researched the Bartow family. They were indeed early settlers of Brookhaven, along with the Hawkins family. I found records of the main Bartow cemetery on the north side of the refuge, but nothing about a second burial ground. I showed my photos to my dad, who showed them to Mike. Mike swore he'd never seen that cemetery before, even though he'd worked at Wertheim for 15 years and thought he knew every inch of the place. The next day, I convinced my dad and Mike to come back with me. We followed the same path using the GPS coordinates from my phone. We searched for hours. We never found the cemetery again. I've gone back a dozen times since then, using maps, GPS, landmarks, everything. It's like that clearing never existed. Sometimes I wonder if I imagined the whole thing, but then I look at the photos on my phone. Gravestones, the rusty fence, the barren ground, and in one photo, barely visible in the background, what might be the outline of fingers pressing up against the surface of the dirt. I don't hike in Wertheim anymore. Story 7. I never used to believe in ghosts. That changed 3 years ago. My name's Marcus. I live in this old converted warehouse apartment in downtown Portland, one of those industrial chic places with exposed brick and ductwork that seemed cool when I signed the lease. The building used to be some kind of textile factory back in the early 1900s. 20 units now, though half are vacant since rent keeps climbing. That night in December, I was up late working on a deadline. Freelance graphic design pays the bills, but sometimes that means 3 a.m. rendering sessions. A blizzard had been hammering the city for hours, and the wind howled through the building's ancient bones, making all kinds of weird noises. Around 3:30, I got up to make more coffee. My apartment has this weird layout. The kitchen is separated from my office space by a short hallway, with my bedroom and bathroom branching off. As I shuffled toward the kitchen, the power flickered once, twice, then went out completely. "Shit," I muttered, feeling my way along the wall. The emergency lights in the hallway outside my apartment kicked on, casting a dim glow under my door. It was just enough to see vague shapes. I was about to grab my phone for the flashlight when I heard it. Footsteps, heavy ones, right outside my door. No big deal, I thought. Probably just a neighbor checking the circuit breaker. But then I remembered, the unit next to mine had been empty for months. The footsteps stopped directly in front of my door. I froze mid-step. Knock, knock, knock. Three slow, deliberate knocks. At 3:30 a.m., during a blackout. Hello, I called out, my voice embarrassingly shaky. Who's there? Silence. Just the howl of the wind outside. I crept toward the door, heart hammering against my ribs. The peephole showed only darkness. The emergency lights in the hall must have failed too. Building manager? I tried again. Is there a problem? Nothing. Then the knocking came again. Louder this time, more insistent. Knock. 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 I jumped back. Who's there? I shouted, anger replacing fear. It's the middle of the night. My phone was still in my office. Should I call someone? The building manager? The police? Before I could decide, I heard something that made my blood run cold. A key. In my lock. Turning. I never gave anyone a key, not even my girlfriend at the time. I lunged forward and slammed my weight against the door, fumbling with the deadbolt just as the handle began to turn. Get the fuck away from my door, I yelled, trying to sound tough while internally panicking. The handle stopped turning. The key withdrew. I pressed my ear against the door, listening. Nothing. No footsteps walking away. No sounds at all except my own ragged breathing. After what felt like forever, I worked up the courage to look through the peephole again. A face stared back at me. I jerked away from the door so hard I fell backward onto the floor, because what I'd seen wasn't possible. The face was pale, almost translucent, eyes like black holes, and it was hovering at least 7 feet off the ground. I scrambled backward on my hands and feet like a crab, unable to even scream. My back hit the wall and I sat there, paralyzed. The knocking started again, but different now, not on the door. It was coming from the windows, all of my windows at once. Tap, 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 like fingernails on glass, 15 floors up. My phone. I needed my phone. I forced myself to move, crawling toward my office, not daring to stand. The power suddenly came back on, lights blazing to life. The knocking stopped instantly. I grabbed my phone with trembling hands and called the building manager. Marcus, do you know what time it is? He grumbled. Someone tried to get into my apartment, I said, my voice cracking. They had a key. He was silent for a moment. That's impossible. Only I have the master keys and I'm in bed. Well, someone was just at my door trying to get in. Look, I'll check the security cameras in the morning. Probably just someone drunk at the wrong apartment. Go back to sleep. He hung up. I sat there clutching my phone, too afraid to move. The next morning, I met the building manager in his office. He pulled up the security footage from the hallway outside my apartment. See? Nothing, he said, pointing at the screen. The footage showed my hallway from 3 a.m. to 4 a.m., empty. No one approached my door. That can't be right, I insisted. Check the timing again. He sighed but scrolled through more footage. Still nothing. What about when the power went out? I asked. Backup generator kicks in for the security system, he said. There was no interruption in recording. I left his office feeling sick. I knew what I'd heard, what I'd seen. 2 days later, I was talking to Mrs. Chen from down the hall. She's been in the building since before the conversion, one of those tenants with rent control they can't kick out. You're in 1507, aren't you? She asked. When I nodded, she frowned. Be careful there. Why's that? She lowered her voice. That apartment, bad things happened there. Before the conversion, a foreman. They say he locked a girl in that room during a fire. She couldn't get out. I moved out the next day, left most of my stuff behind. Some things aren't worth trying to explain. I never did figure out what happened that night. Story 8. I never believed in ghosts, not until last summer anyway. I'm Ryan, 32, living in a small town outside Portland where nothing ever happens. At least that's what I thought. It started when I got a call from my Uncle Dave, who'd passed away 3 months earlier. Yeah, you read that right. I was home alone on a Tuesday night, half asleep on the couch with some Netflix show playing in the background. It was around 11:30 when my phone rang. Unknown number. I almost didn't answer. Hello? I mumbled, static. Then a voice. distant but unmistakable. Ryan? It's Dave. My blood went cold. The voice, gravelly, familiar, belonged to my Uncle Dave, the same uncle whose funeral I'd attended that spring. Who is this? I managed to say. It's Dave. I need help. The basement. The line crackled, breaking up his words. What basement? Who the fuck is this? I was fully awake now, heart pounding. My house. Something found. Please. The call cut off. I sat there staring at my phone, trying to make sense of what just happened. Maybe a sick prank, but nobody could imitate Uncle Dave's voice that perfectly. I called the number back. Nothing. Straight to some automated message saying the number wasn't in service. I tried three more times with the same result. I couldn't sleep that night. By morning, I'd convinced myself it was just some weird technical glitch or a cruel joke. But then I got a text from the same number. Basement. Please. That's when I made the decision I've regretted every day since. I drove to Uncle Dave's old house. It had been sitting empty since he died. My aunt couldn't bear to sell it yet, but couldn't live there either. I still had the spare key. The place smelled musty, like old books and dust. Everything was exactly as he'd left it. Half-empty coffee mug on the kitchen counter, reading glasses beside his favorite chair. Newspaper from the day he died still folded on the coffee table. I stood in the foyer, feeling like an intruder. Hello? I called out. My voice echoed through the empty house. No response. Of course not. What was I expecting? The basement door was at the end of the hallway. Uncle Dave had used it as a workshop. He'd been an amateur woodworker. I hadn't been down there in years. My hand trembled as I turned the knob. The door creaked open, revealing concrete steps disappearing into darkness. I fumbled for the light switch. Nothing happened. The bulb must have burned out. I turned on my phone's flashlight and started down the stairs, each step creaking under my weight. The basement air was cold and damp, smelling faintly of sawdust and something else. Something metallic. Hello, I called again, my voice smaller now. The beam from my phone illuminated the workspace, tools hanging on pegboards, half-finished projects on the workbench, sawdust covering everything. And then I saw it. In the far corner, where the light barely reached, was an old trunk I'd never seen before. It looked antique, with brass fittings and dark wood. It didn't belong among Uncle Dave's modern tools. I approached slowly, my footsteps echoing on the concrete floor. The trunk wasn't locked. As I reached for the lid, my phone dinged. Another text, "Don't open it," from the same number. I yanked my hand back like I'd been burned. My breath came in short gasps, forming small clouds in the cold air. Then I heard it, a sound coming from inside the trunk, a scratching like fingernails against wood. I backed away, nearly tripping over a sawhorse. The scratching grew louder, more frantic, and then whispers. So faint I could barely hear them, but definitely there. Multiple voices, overlapping, urgent. Help us. Let us out. Please. My back hit the wall. I couldn't take my eyes off the trunk as the whispers grew louder, the scratching more desperate. Then my phone rang again, the same number. With shaking hands, I answered. What is happening? Uncle Dave's voice came through, clearer this time. Ryan, listen carefully. Don't open that trunk. Whatever you do, it's not me calling you. It's not me texting you. It's them. They're using my voice. Who? I whispered. They want out. They've been trapped for decades. I found the trunk at an estate sale. Didn't know what it was. But once I brought it home, his voice broke. They killed me, Ryan. Heart attack, the doctor said. But it was them. They drained me until there was nothing left. The whispering from the trunk had stopped. The basement was suddenly, terrifyingly silent. Uncle Dave, what do I... A new voice came through the phone. Not my uncle's. This one was deeper, hollow, like it was coming from the bottom of a well. We know you're here, Ryan. I dropped the phone. It clattered on the concrete floor, the screen shattering. The scratching started again, more violent now. The trunk began to shake. I ran. Up the stairs, through the house, out the front door. I didn't stop until I reached my car, fumbling with the keys, my hands slick with sweat. As I pulled away from the curb, I glanced back at the house. In the basement window, I saw shapes moving in the darkness, formless, shifting shadows pressing against the glass. My phone is ringing again as I'm writing this. Unknown number. It hasn't stopped for 3 days, and now I'm getting texts from my mom, my sister, my best friend, all of them asking me to come over to help them with something in their basement. I'm not answering. I'm not going anywhere. Story 9. I never believed in ghosts until I moved to North Lake, Illinois, small town about 20 miles west of Chicago. I'd found this dirt-cheap rental on Willard Street, a two-story Victorian that needed work but had character, as the landlord put it. What he failed to mention was why the rent was so low. First night there, I woke up around 3 a.m. to the sound of crying. Not loud sobbing, but this soft, muffled whimpering coming from somewhere upstairs. My bedroom was on the main floor, and the upper level was just empty rooms I was using for storage. I figured it was probably just the pipes or something. Old houses make weird noises, right? But then it happened again the next night, and the night after that. Always around 3 a.m., always the same sad, quiet crying. After a week of this, I mentioned it to my neighbor while getting the mail. Mrs. Patel, sweet lady in her 70s who'd lived next door for decades. "You're hearing it too?" she asked, lowering her voice like someone might be listening. "The crying?" My stomach dropped. "Wait, you've heard it before?" She nodded. "The Willard house has always had issues. The family before you only lasted 2 months." "What happened to them?" Mrs. Patel just shook her head. "They never said. Just packed up and left." That night, I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about what Mrs. Patel had said. Around 2:30 a.m., I decided I was being ridiculous. There had to be a logical explanation. Maybe raccoons in the attic or wind through a crack somewhere. I grabbed my phone for a flashlight and headed upstairs. The upper floor was cold, like unnaturally cold compared to downstairs. The boxes I'd stacked in the hallway cast weird shadows in my phone light. I checked the first empty bedroom. Nothing. Second room. Also nothing. The bathroom was clear. That left only the small room at the end of the hall. It had been locked when I moved in. Landlord said he'd lost the key years ago, and I hadn't bothered with it since I had plenty of other space. I approached the door listening. Nothing at first. Then, there it was. The crying. Soft, heartbreaking sobs coming from behind the locked door. "Hello?" I called out, my voice shaking. "Is someone in there?" The crying stopped immediately. I stood frozen, heart pounding in my chest. Then I heard something that still makes my skin crawl when I think about it. A small, childlike voice from inside the room. "Help me. She locked me in again." My blood turned to ice. I couldn't move. "Please," the voice whispered. "I'm so hungry." I backed away from the door, nearly tripping over a box. Who are you?" No response, just silence. Then I heard what sounded like small fingernails scratching at the inside of the door. Gentle at first, then more frantic. "She's coming," the voice whispered urgently. "She always comes when I talk to people. Don't let her see you." The scratching stopped. The hallway temperature plummeted further. I could see my breath now. Something moved in my peripheral vision at the top of the stairs. I spun around but saw nothing there. "Please," the child's voice pleaded one more time. "Just open the door." I turned back toward the room, and that's when I heard it. Heavy footsteps coming up the stairs behind me. Slow, deliberate steps. But when I looked, there was nobody there. The footsteps continued, invisible but unmistakable, coming closer. "She's here," the child's voice whimpered. The doorknob to the locked room began to turn back and forth violently, rattling as if someone was desperately trying to get out. I couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Then suddenly the rattling stopped. The hallway went silent. For a moment I thought it was over. That's when I felt cold breath on the back of my neck and heard a woman's voice, harsh and angry, whisper directly into my ear, "He stays locked up. Forever." I don't remember running downstairs. Don't remember grabbing my keys and wallet. I just remember sitting in my car, shaking, at a 24-hour McDonald's parking lot until sunrise. I broke my lease the next day. Mrs. Patel wasn't surprised when I told her I was moving out. Before I left, she finally told me what she knew. Back in the 1970s, a woman had lived there with her son. Neighbors reported hearing fights, but nobody intervened. One day, the woman just disappeared. Nobody ever saw the boy again. Story 10, I grew up just outside Dunlap, Tennessee, out in the sticks. Nothing out there but winding roads, rotting barns, and forests so thick you could scream your lungs out and no one would ever hear you. That's not a metaphor either. It's kind of the local legend. There's this bridge out past Stone Creek. No name, just the bridge. Kids used to say if you parked on it after midnight and shut everything off, the bridge would scream at you. Not something under it, the bridge. I always called bullshit on that. Anyway, last summer, I went back home for a week to visit my folks. Caught up with some old friends one night, guys I grew up with. I hadn't seen them in years. We had some beers, swapped stories, ended up out back on the porch, and eventually someone brought up the bridge. We all laughed it off, but then Josh goes, "We should go. Right now." We were buzzed but not hammered, just stupid enough to follow through. Five of us piled into Mason's rusted out Ford, and around 1 a.m., we were pulling onto that bridge like a bunch of idiots in a horror movie. We cut the headlights, rolled down the windows, killed the engine. It was dead quiet, not peaceful quiet, thick quiet, like the woods were holding their breath. For the first 30 minutes, nothing happened, just crickets and the occasional tree creaking. I sat in the middle back seat, starting to feel like an idiot. Josh was in the passenger seat, running his mouth, trying to psych us up. "I heard it sounds like a woman getting murdered," he said. Mason muttered, "It's just a bobcat. My uncle says they scream like that." "Yeah," I said. "Then why don't you ever hear it from the houses nearby?" No one had an answer. By the 45-minute mark, we were about to pack it in. Then it happened. No warning, just this scream. Right outside my window. I can't explain it. It wasn't a bobcat. I've heard bobcats. This was longer, more human. Like someone being flayed alive with no air in their lungs. 3, maybe 4 seconds of pure agony. It was so loud it felt like it passed through the car, like it was screaming inside our skulls, not around us, through us. We all jumped. Mason fumbled with the keys, stalled the engine. I shouted, "Go!" and smacked the back of his seat. Josh had gone pale, dead silent in the car. Even the crickets had stopped. Then Mason got it started, and we peeled out like hell was on our heels. Nobody said a word until we were about 2 miles down the road. Then the panic hit. I was shaking so hard I couldn't even hold my phone. Felt like my spine was trying to crawl out of my back. Derek, sitting to my right, suddenly shouted, "Pull over!" And Mason did. Derek jumped out and threw up in the ditch. Meanwhile, Josh just sat there, still as a statue. I turned and looked at him. And saw it. He'd pissed himself, full on soaked the seat. I didn't say anything. None of us did. Not even Mason, whose car it was. That's how messed up we were. No jokes, no comments, just silence. "I saw something," Mason muttered. We all turned. In the rear view, when it screamed, like a shadow by the guardrail. I didn't see anything. I felt something, sure. Like the air had shifted, like something had brushed the car. Or us. But I didn't see a shadow. I didn't want to. Derek just got back in the car and shut the door, like it was keeping something out. We drove back in silence. No one even asked what that was. We didn't need to. We knew it wasn't an animal. It wasn't a prank. There was no one else out there. That road doesn't lead to anything. No trails, no campsites. Just the bridge in the woods. I never went back. And I don't think any of the others did either. I've heard people say fear makes you imagine things, but it wasn't just fear. I've been scared. This was different. This felt wrong. Like we weren't supposed to be there. Like we'd heard something we weren't meant to hear. Like whatever made that noise didn't want to scare us. It wanted to be heard. And that scream, I still hear it sometimes when I'm alone. Not like a memory, like an echo. Like it left something behind. I don't know what's under that bridge or in it. But if you ever find yourself near Stone Creek in Tennessee and someone dares you to go out there, do yourself a favor. Don't. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also, hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.